Welcome to Sisi Radha Gopinath Mandir Sunday Feast Program. This afternoon, Kaustubha Prabhu and myself have decided to discuss the topic of Guru Tattva. And as was mentioned in the introduction, Kaustubha Prabhu will be speaking about his personal experience of taking association of Guru, and I'll be speaking on a more historical point of view, referring to our classic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, where in the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, a detailed analysis of the relationship between Guru and disciple is given in the example of Srila Vyasadeva and Sri Narad Muni. So I'll be speaking on that subject for some time, and we'll be looking at a few statements Prabhupada makes in that relation. And then Kaustubha Prabhu will bring it to a more contemporary angle, and he'll be discussing his own experiences of association with Gurudev Srila Tamalkrishna Goswami Maharaj. Om Gyana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chokshush Unmilitang Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Srimad Bhagavatam begins with the sages at Naima Sharanya inquiring from Sutta Goswami after the departure of Sri Krishna to his own abode, where have the religious principles gone? So Sutta Goswami, he replies to the sage's question. Krishna svadamu pagate dharma jnanadi vishaha kalo nashtadrisham mesha puranako dunoditaha. He says that those persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of the Kali Yuga, kalo nashta drisham, the drishi is nashta, they're unable to see reality and understand the actual situation of material existence. So Sutta Goswami explains that for such people, after the departure of Lord Krishna, because when Lord Krishna was on the planet, then everything was auspicious and dharma, religious principles, were manifest in the rupa, in the form of the Lord being present there. After his departure, what is the repository of religious principles? So Sutta Goswami explains that Krishna svadamu pagade dharma jnana adibhishaha. Krishna's left his planet accompanied by religion and knowledge. Kalu nastadrisham esha. Again, those who are remaining in this Kali Yuga, who are blinded by the material consciousness of Kali Yuga, puranako aduno ditaha. They will get light. Aduno ditaha, just like the rising sun. They will get illumination and knowledge, puranako, from this Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam. And he goes on to explain many wonderful verses glorifying Srimad Bhagavatam. Puranam Brahma Sanghitam, that this Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of Krishna. And one can derive all the benefit from direct association with Krishna that is possible by association with this Srimad Bhagavatam. So, hearing this, the sages who were present there, they inquired from Sutta Goswami, where did Srila Vyasadeva get the inspiration to compile Srimad Bhagavatam? So in response to that question, What was Vyasadeva's inspiration to compile Srimad Bhagavatam? Sutta Goswami, he begins to explain and narrate the, we could say, the story of Vyasadeva and his association with his Gurudev Srila Narad Muni. And as a result of that meeting between Vyasadeva and Narad Muni, Vyas got inspiration to compile Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus we now have Srimad Bhagavatam available, whereby we can attain all of the mercy and all of the benefits that are available from direct association with the Lord Himself. So Vyasadeva, we know his important role. His Krishna Dwaipayan Vyas. Actually, the title Vyas, that is the title. And it's indicative of the particular responsibility of that avatar, Shakyavesh avatar. So this particular Vyasadeva, his name was Krishna Dwaipayan. So the particular responsibility of Vyasadeva is to compile the Vedic literature. So as explained, Sudha Goswami begins to narrate that Vyasadeva was sitting in his cottage, Bhadrik Ashram, and because of his spiritual power, he was able to see, visionary, he was able to see the predicament that the conditioned souls would be facing in Kali Yuga. Therefore, in order to rectify the situation, the unfortunate situation of being a resident of Kali Yuga, Vyasadeva took it upon him to compile Vedic wisdom in a literary form. Prior to Vyas' appearance, the Vedas were in the Shabda Brahman, in the sound form, the Sruti mantras, and there was no book form of Veda. The Sruti mantra, Sruti means that which is heard. And because the residents of the previous ages were more qualified, so they could remember Sruti Dhara, they could capture just by hearing. But we don't have that quality in the Kali Yuga, therefore it required to write it down. So Vyasadeva, he divided the Veda, Veda Vyas, who divides. And as you know, there are four Vedas, Rig, Sama, Atharva, Yajur. Originally there was the Yajur Veda, so he divided. And he had his disciples, he had his whole team working on that project. And we know that Vyasa's contribution is extremely enormous, extremely magnanimous, because he compiled the four Vedas and he compiled the Upanishads in addition to the Vedic literature. And he compiled the Vedanta Sutra, Brahma Sutras by Srila Vyasadeva. And he also compiled the Puranas and the Itihas, Mahabharata. So this is a great work and a great project. So Bhagavatam is explaining in these first chapters that in spite of compiling all of this literature, and it was meant for, the reason why, I'll just read, Prabhupada's explaining why Vyasadeva divided the Vedas. There is a stricture, this is from text 19 purport to chapter 4 of first canto of Bhagavatam. There is a stricture that no one should try to learn the Vedas who is not a qualified Brahman. The Vedas are subjects which had to be explained even to Brahmaji, by the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the subject matter is understood by persons with exceptional qualities of goodness. Persons who are in the modes of passion and ignorance are unable to understand subject matter of the Vedas. In the present age, the mode of goodness is almost nil. And so, for the general mass of people, the kind-hearted, powerful sage Srila Vyasadeva divided the Vedas in various ways so that they may be practically followed by the less intelligent persons in the modes of passion and ignorance. So for this reason, Vyasadeva divided the Vedas into different sections. Also goes on to explain about Mahabharata. The essence of Vedic wisdom is there in Mahabharata. But people in the Kali Yuga, they generally like to hear stories. And they're not so attracted to the philosophy and of the mantras, the Vedas. So in this way, Prabhupada explains that Vyas and Krishna collaborated to... Vyas compiled Mahabharata, which is full of stories, politics, drama, heroism, romance, chivalry, all of the things we like to hear about. And within that, Krishna spoke Srimad Bhagavad Gita, which is the essence of all the Vedic wisdom. So in this way, message was given. However, Vyasadeva, in spite of compiling all of this Vedic literature, he felt unsatisfied. This in itself is a very interesting point. If the compiler of the Vedic literature himself, who knows the Vedic literature better than anyone else and all of its details and all of its components, if he himself is unsatisfied after compiling the Vedic literature, what to speak of those so-called Vedantists and scholars of the Vedas who are trying to get some satisfaction from study of the Vedanta? Absolutely impossible. Murka tumi tumar nahika Vedanta arika. Mahaprabhu, Srila Ishvara Puri said, you're a fool, you have no qualifications to study Vedanta. Krishna naam, japashara e mantra shah. You just chant Hare Krishna Maha Mantra all the time. So from this point, we can understand that Vedic literature, very difficult to understand and approach. Even Vyasadeva wasn't satisfied having compiled it. At that time, Brahmanda Brahmetagon Bhagwana Jeev, Guru Krishna Prasad, Poi Bhakti Lotabij. By the mercy of Krishna and Guru, Srila Vyasadeva, out of his own will, arrived at the ashram of Narad Muni. The guru of Vyasadeva, he arrived at his ashram in Badrik Ashram. So it's explained that immediately Narad Muni was able to, Prabhupada explains, the prompt diagnosis of Sri Narad is at once declared. Prompt diagnosis, very quickly he came to the point. Jata dharma dayascharta. You have very broadly described the four principles, dharma, artha, kama, moksha, in the Vedic literature. Natata vasudevasha mahima. But you have not described the glories of the Supreme Lord Vasudev. Prabhupada comments, the root cause of the despondency of Vyasadeva was his deliberate avoidance of glorifying the Lord and in his various editions of the Puranas. And still, instead of giving more importance to the better type of engagement, namely devotional service to the Lord, he had more or less improperly used his valuable time. Thus, he was despondent. Narad goes on to give more explicit instruction to Vyas. Narad is stressing the particular defect in the Vedic literature. Defect in the Vedic literature. What is that? He's trying to emphasize describing everything in relation. Prabhupada's commenting in a lecture. Because, he's explaining the mistake of Srila Vyasadeva. Because they will accept you as authority. They will think this is religion. They will not make further progress. They will stick to that principle. Therefore, it is abominable. Narad Muni's words to Vyasadeva were very severe, very cutting, abominable. We'll hear more shortly. He's explaining, Prabhupada's commenting, when they will be advised about higher truths, what is that? Devotional service. Service to the Lord. Service to Vaishnavas. Giving up of material attachment. Then, if these things are instructed for higher elevation of life, they will not accept. They will not accept. They will say, it is my religion. I must do it. Because the Vedic Karmakanda sections are explaining how you can religiously enjoy your material desires and fulfill your material desires in this material world. So, Prabhupada's commenting, Vyasadeva, as the authority in Vedic explanations, his encouragement in sense enjoyment to some extent is a great barrier for spiritual advancement. Vyasadeva says we can do it. So it's religious. Let us do it. The people in general will not agree to renounce material activities which lead them into material bondage. Prabhupada gives an analogy. The expert physician does not make any compromise with the patient by allowing him to take partially what he should not take at all. So this is the criticism that Narad gave Vyasadeva. You have done a horrible thing. Actually, you have created a barrier for people achieving the ultimate goal of life. Of course, this is confidential. This is Vaishnava Siddhanta. This is the special flavor of Bhagavad Katha and Bhagavad Dharma. Better people are religious, the better they do karma according to the Vedic rituals than vikarma, complete sinful activity. But Bhagavad Dharma is transcendental to this religious pious activity as being described by Narad. He explains compromising spirit of Vyasadeva is directly condemned by Narad Muni. Prabhupada explains that this is the responsibility of the guru. He quotes from Chanaka Pandit, Putram cha shishyam cha tarayet na tu lalayet. The father and teacher is advised by Chanaka Pandit, you should always chastise your son and disciple. Simply chastise, always find out mistake. Even a great soul like Vyasadeva, who is the Shaktivesh avatar, he had guru, and the guru, Srila Narad Muni, performed his responsibility of pointing out the faults of the disciple. So we're hoping, we're all eagerly awaiting that Kashtubha Prabhu will be able to narrate some nice stories of his own experience, where Srila Tamal Krishna Maharaj has also been exemplary in fulfilling this responsibility of the guru. Prabhupada comments his own guru was very chastising. He says that he explains if that was so. As far as we are concerned, when our spiritual master used to chastise, Prabhupada's talking about Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. We took it as a blessing. That was very nice, and he would chastise like anything. Damn, rascal, foolish, stupid. So Narad goes on to explain very strong words. Nayad vachash chitrapadang hader jasho jagat pavitram pogrinita kahich chit tadvayasam tirtam ukshanti manasa nayatra hangsha niramat yushikshaya. He says that those words, even though they're chitrapadan, very decorative, nayad vachash chitrapadan hader jasha, if they are not glorifying Hari, Tadvayasam tirtam ukshanti manasa. He says that the thinking, the intelligent people, manasa, consider such literatures to be tadvayasam tirtam. Vayasam means the crow. Vayasam tirtam means the place of pilgrimage for crows. Prabhupada in his lecture, very strong words. Prabhupada's commenting. Narad is comparing all the books written by Vyas, including Vedanta philosophy. He says this is Vyasam Tirtham. Vyasam means crow, and the crow and their place of pleasure. You have seen crows? In India, we have got many crows. Yes. In your country, crows are not very. America, New York, New Brindavan, 1969. But in India, the crows, they take pleasure in all nasty things. The crows, you'll find they will take pleasure in a place where all nasty things are thrown garbage. They'll pick out the garbage, find out where there is mucus, where there is pus, just like flies. They'll sit down on the stool. Narad Muni is comparing the Vedic literature compiled by Vyasadeva to this. Very strong words. This is guru. He goes on to explain. However, Tadbag Bisharga Janataga Viplama Yashmin Pratishlokama Badya Vatyapi Namani Anantashayoshon Kintaniat Srinvanti Goyan Tigrinanti Sarva. He says, on the other hand, that literature, Tadbag Bisharga, which is Namani Anantashayosho Kintaniat, glorifying the name, the qualities, the pastimes, the form of Lord Hari, that literature, Janathaga Viplava, is so powerful that it can create a revolution in the Janathaga. Aga means sinful. Janathaga means the sinful people. Viplava means revolution. Prabhupada's commenting. Narada is comparing your so-called books about Dharma, Artha, Karma, and Moksha, just like the kark or the crow's pleasure hunting. But if you produce a single literature wherein simply there is glorification of God, anyone who will read, he'll derive some immediate transcendental benefit. Produce one page only, back to Godhead. Oh, that will bring a revolution to the human society about understanding of spiritual life. This is recommended by Narad. Tadvag bisharga janathaga viplava. Janathaga, sinful activities, sinful people. If one reads one line of this literature, although it is presented in broken language, but still, if he simply hears there is Krishna, then his sinful activities immediately vanquish. In the purport to this verse, Prabhupada is revealing some very, we could say, important concepts or conclusions. He says, therefore, there is a great need for disseminating the message of Srimad Bhagavatam all over the world. It's the duty of every responsible Indian to broadcast the transcendental message of Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the world, to do the supermost good as well as to bring about desired peace in the world. Because India has failed in her duty by neglecting this responsible work, there is so much quarrel and trouble all over the world. Where did Srila Vyasadeva appear? Where did Narad Muni appear? Where did Sri Krishna appear and speak Gita Upadesh? Where did Ram, Lakshman and Hanuman appear? They appeared here in this Bharat Bhumi. Therefore, those people from Bharat, it is their responsibility to spread the teachings of Krishna, the teachings of Ram, the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu all over the world. It is their responsibility, your responsibility. Prabhupada took up this responsibility. One man. And see what he was able to do. Here, this verse predicting Prabhupada's contribution to mankind. Janathaga Viplava, a revolution. Yeah, we are from the foreign countries. We are examples of Janathaga, sinful people. And yet there has been Viplava, revolution, as a result of coming in contact with Prabhupada's literature. Another revealing statement Prabhupada makes in response to Yashmin Prati Shlokam Abhadevadyapi, even though there may be so many imperfections in the presentation, Prabhupada comments, we know that our honest attempt to present this great literature conveying transcendental message to reviving the God consciousness of the people in general and re-spiritualizing the world atmosphere is fraught with many difficulties. Our presenting this matter in inadequate language, especially a foreign language, will certainly fail. There will be so many literary discrepancies despite our honest attempt to present it in a proper way. But we are sure, with all our faults in this connection, the seriousness of the subject matter will be taken into consideration and the leaders of the society will accept this due to it being an honest attempt to glorify the Almighty God. So we can see that Prabhupada, in his service to his Guru Maharaj, he is actually inheriting the same message that Sri Narad Muni gave to Vyasadeva. And this is the actual essence of the parampara system. Prabhupada gives an example of when you contact electricity, that there's the powerhouse, and it is the generation source of all the electric power. But in every house, in every room, in every office, you find the plug in the wall. And the plug is much more accessible than that powerhouse, which is way out there somewhere in the hills. We can get all the benefits of contacting the powerhouse just by touching the plug in the wall. So this is the Prabhupada gives this analogy to explain by parampara. That just by coming is what meant by bona fide. Bona fide, the word means authorized. An authorized representative. In other words, he will be, contacting him will be as good as contacting the Lord himself. Evam paramparam prabdam. In fact, Krishna explains in the fourth chapter of the Gita that I cannot be approached in any other way. Imam, that to get me parampara praptam, you have to go through this process of the parampara succession. So what is it that makes the guru authorized to be a representative of the parampara? That is, he's giving the same message. He's presenting the same teachings. So Narad, he heard from Brahmaji. Brahmaji, he heard Chatushloki Bhagavatam from Govinda. And that same teaching, Sri Narad, is here inspiring by his very association. He's rectifying all of the misconceptions of Vyasadeva, and he's clearly establishing what is the ultimate principle of religion, what is the ultimate desire of the Lord. And through that association with Narad, Vyasadeva, actually, he has a great revelation and a change in his whole approach. In spite of, you know, we have the tendency to rest on our laurels. You do something good. You know, I've done so much work. I'm a graduate, or I have this position in the office. And then we tend to, I'm an author. Sometimes speakers are introduced. He's an author of several books. Wow. Here, Vyasadeva had, you know, surpassed, his contribution had surpassed, incomparable to what any modern so-called writer could possibly do now. And yet he was not satisfied with that. Still, he went on to compile Srimad Bhagavatam as a result of hearing this instruction from Narad. In fact, he felt that he had misused his position as spiritual authority, and it had to be rectified in the compilation of Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam, it begins with a very clear statement indicating this book is different. Dharma projita kaitava atra parama. In this book, there is no compromise. There is no pretentious religion. No, so-called religion, which is mixed with the fruitive desires of conditional consciousness. It is atra parama, the supreme truth. That's the second verse. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. The opening verses. This book is meant for glorification of Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So for this reason, we understand that Mahaprabhu's teachings, that Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam, it is the highest evidence. Sri Chaitanya Mata Idam Tatradarana Paraha. There is no conclusion higher to this, what is taught in Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, Vaishnavanam Priyam. We only need read Srimad Bhagavatam. So we can see this is the essence of Narad's teachings to Vyas. All of this Vedic literature, this Karmakanda, Varnas, all of this is, you're confusing the people. Just teach them their relationship with Krishna and how to satisfy Krishna. That is the real thing. And we saw Prabhupada, he caught that very essence of the message of the Parampara and presents it in every page of his literature. In fact, the scholars, they criticize Prabhupada that, here in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is talking about karma yoga. Krishna is talking about vanashram dharma. Krishna is encouraging jnana. But on every page, you are writing, chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You are talking about bhakti on every page. But actually, this is the mood of Narad Muni. This is the mood of our parampara. This is Prabhupada's authorization as representative of the parampara and representative of Govinda's desire. Govinda says in the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharman Puridjaga, you give up everything else I've said, Mamekang Sharanam, and you just worship me, Manamana, think of me, Bhavamad Bhakta, become my devotee, Madhyaji Mam, Satatam Kirtayanto Mam, you always glorify me. So Prabhupada, out of his mercy, Prabhupada comments in the purport, these sections of Gita, he says that this is an example because Krishna says not to disturb those on the lower level. Let them gradually continue. Don't disturb them. Let them perform pious activities. Prabhupada says, however, a person that's more, a little more, we could say, fortunate, he can immediately be taught about his eternal relationship, his swadharma, eternal duty to satisfy the Lord. Prabhupada says, this is an example of how the devotee is more merciful than the Lord. And Krishna, not so succinct, not so obvious in the Gita Upadesha. She's saying so many things from different angles. But out of mercy, Prabhupada is actually presenting Krishna's real intention, his real message on every page. Because Prabhupada knows Kali Yuga people will never read the whole book. Unless, of course, you're fortunate to come and take study Bhakti Shastri with us. You get to the end. But generally, we never even get to the end. We never find out the punchline. No, we're supposed to give up all this other stuff. Mam ekang sharanam. I never got to that part. So Prabhupada understands the lack of qualification that we have. So on every page, he's making it very clear. But we should understand this is not some invention of Prabhupada. This is not some, his idea. This is his authority. This is the particular, this is why Prabhupada's movement is having so much success all over the world. Because Srinvanti Gayanti Grinanti Sarava, Prabhupada, on the basis of this verse, you can see he's designing his whole strategy. The people will accept the real thing. Grinanti Sarava, those who are honest, those who are actually sincere to solve the problem of material existence and come to their eternal position of service to the Lord, those people, they will accept Prabhupada's writings immediately. Because we can see that this is the direct desire of the Lord to serve Him, please Him, and this is the consciousness of a pure devotee, and this is imbued, this consciousness is imbued in every page, every line of Prabhupada's writing. Jashmin prati shlokam, every syllable, Prabhupada is very much inheriting this mood of Narad. Janataga Viplava. Every one line, Prabhupada said, they read one line, it's sufficient. As soon as they hear about Krishna. So Narad's going on to conclude his teachings to Vyas that, therefore, those who are not so well situated due to material attachment should be shown the ways of transcendental realization by your goodness through descriptions of the transcendental activities of the Supreme Lord. They should be shown the way of purification through descriptions of the transcendental activities of the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada commenting on this in lecturing in New Brindavan, 1969. So how can it be achieved, ceasing this materialistic way of life? So Narad Muni says, you simply describe the activities of the Lord, Krishna, and by hearing simply the activities of Krishna, one will be very easily able to cease from this materialistic way of life. Simply let them hear. Let them give oral reception to the wonderful activities of the Lord. This is Narad's message to Vyasadeva. You don't worry anymore about all of this flowery Vedic stuff. You just glorify Lord Hari. You glorify his devotees. You glorify his pastimes. You glorify his name. That is the only thing that is required to solve the problem of conditioned life. Now we see that Prabhupada inherited this message. He built his whole institution on this message. Why did he spend, you know, give up sleep, spend 2 hours rest every night? This wasn't some business strategy. Because he knew what is the actual Siddhanta, what is the teachings of our Parampara, what is the real message of Govinda? It is to facilitate the hearing and chanting process. And Prabhupada, he gave himself to fulfilling this mission. The order Prabhupada got from Srila Bhakti Sananta Maharaj that you go, same thing, it's reflected, we see it. The guru comes immediately, makes it very clear. You're a fool. Disciple should always remain a fool in the presence of the spiritual master. Even a great soul like Srila Vyasadeva, we can see. Now the same message is there, that without the association of the Sri Guru, and the we shall Shakshat Hari, non-different from the Lord. He has that power to, in this same section, Vyasadeva is explaining that you are just like the all-pervading super soul, and you're able to enter into my heart and perceive what is the trouble there. Chaita Guru, The guru, the spiritual master manifests, super soul, manifestation. And those words, chitete koriyage, we need nothing else. We need here nothing else apart from the direction given by the spiritual master. And Prabhupada explains. He says, this was my only credit. Prabhupada says, this is the secret to success. If you don't remember anything, what we've explained today, you remember this one thing. What is the secret? What is the secret of spiritual life? Secret is to accept the words of one's spiritual master as one's mission in life. Prabhupada said, this is my only credit, that I believed in the words of my spiritual master. You go and you preach in English language all over the world. And I accepted this, even though immediately I was unable to fulfill. I accepted this order. I made the mission of my life to fulfill this order. And thus, Prabhupada became that authorized representative, that Krishna Shakti Bina Nahitara Pravatana, because he had that desire, not my interest, Guru's interest. Thus, he was able to get the Krishna Shakti. He was able to imbibe, to reflect, to, we could say, absorb, transfer, and the transparent via medium. He was able to connect to that Krishna Shakti, and he was able to distribute that Krishna Shakti. Janataga Viplava, that the Lord himself has the power to purify the conditioned souls. And Prabhupada, through his purity, is able to connect us to the association of the Lord. This is not meant for simply this study of Vedic literature, association. We accept a guru as a fashion, Prabhupada says. Yes, I have a guru. I have a guru. He comes on television every day. He's so famous, and I'm his disciple. So I'm so wonderful. He's my guru. It's not some fashion. Accepting the guru means acharyavan purusho veda. Acharyavan purusho veda. You accept that order of the guru, then you've achieved the conclusion of Vedic study. Acharyavan, one who has guru, purusho veda. He is a Vedanta. He is the knower of the Vedas. But acharyavan, that doesn't mean, acharyavan doesn't mean I have a guru, here's his picture. It's not a possession. Acharyavan means that I've accepted the guru as my Lord. That is acharyavan. One who has a guru, one who is acharyavan is servant of guru. That is acharyavan. One who accepts this mission to serve the spiritual master as his mission in life, that person gets the full mercy of the Lord. So in this way, we can see that the Srimad Bhagavatam is there for helping us, for our guidance in spiritual guru sharu shastra. That when we see what our guru is teaching, what Prabhupada is teaching, this is not something that he's come up with on his own, but this is the authorized system. Right from the very history of the creation. Lord Brahma, Narad Muni, he came. Mental sons of Lord Brahma, Srila Vyasadeva. This is the standard teachings are there in the scripture. So by hearing these discussions and analyzing them from different points of view, this can help us to actually develop the appropriate attitude in terms of accepting the spiritual master. So in this way, we can see many different principles are there for our application from this story of Narad Muni and Srila Vyasadeva. Like, for example, in spite of your great scholarship, in spite of your knowledge, in spite of your renunciation, in spite of your erudition, if one does not get mercy of Sri Hari through the Hari Bhakta, through the representative, through the Vaishnava, then or all of his so-called material qualifications are of no value. The essence is to get Guru Prasad, get Krishna Prasad through the Guru. That even a great, great personality like Vyasadeva is not beyond making mistakes. So the principle is there. And also a principle of accepting the teachings of the spiritual master as one's life and as one's focus. And also the essential teachings of Vedic wisdom and the conclusion of our parampara is the process of hearing and chanting and the process of glorification of Sri Krishna. So in this way, these principles can be applied in our own lives and they can be applied in our teaching. Jari Deka Tarikaha Krishna Upadesh. What is Krishna Upadesh? Mahaprabhu is ordering us, whoever you see, teach them about Krishna. Amara Agyai Guru Hoy Tara E Desh. It's not that Narad is the only guru. It's not that his teaching is only meant for Vyas and that's the end. It's not that Prabhupada's teachings end with Prabhupada. Amar Agyai Guru Hoy. Mahaprabhu says that we have to carry on this message. We have to become authorized representatives of the Parampara. With the children, they have to carry on the family lineage. It's not some, a guru does everything and now I'm the happy recipient of the mercy. No, we also have responsibility. Just as we have become fortunate, we have to make others fortunate by becoming qualified, by understanding what is the teachings of the Lord, what is the conclusion, what is the process, by applying those fully in our lives, and by being the representative of our guru in spreading those teachings to others. And this way, that's the best for us, and that is the best we can do. And Prabhupada commenting, especially people of India, it's their special responsibility. We've taken up, actually for us, it's all new stuff. We're taken up. But this India, not a poor country. Although they're all wanting to go to the other countries for chakri, for employment. But actually, this is the real wealth. But we're not appreciating. This is our responsibility. Become qualified. Amar Agyai Guru Hoy Tara E Desh. And distribute these teachings of Narad Muni, of Srila Vyasadeva, of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of Srila Prabhupada. Distribute them all over the world. Hare Krishna. Now we'd like to request His Grace Kushtubha Prabhu to continue with this theme of the importance of Guru Tattva, and association with Guru, and particularly share with us some of His own personal experiences in associating and getting the mercy of one of our very wonderful and dear servants of Prabhupada and representatives of Prabhupada's teachings in the Parampara, His Holiness Sri Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj. So, shall we make Kushtubha Prabhu welcome in our traditional way? Haribo! Haribo! Haribo!
Haribo, thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Prabhu, for the very nice instructions. It's good that you speak the Vani, because I'm not very philosophically inclined. And I did, my only qualifications, I did get some mercy of association with my Guru Maharaj, so I can speak a little on the Vapu, about personal association with the Guru. Prabhupada always said, we can read actually many places in his books, Vani, instruction, is more important than Vapu, than the personal association with the Guru. And I remember my Guru Maharaj once looked at me, he said to me, he said, yes, it's true, Vani is more important. And then he stared at me, very sharp. And when he would stare at you with his eyes very fixed, I can't describe in words what it felt like, but it was quite, your heart would drop a bit and you would have a lump in the throat. He said, Vani is more important, it's true. And then he looked at me and said, but Vapu is also. He said it like this. He said, but there's a lot to say for Vapu also. Like that. So he considered that the time that he got with Srila Prabhupada was very, very, very sacred and very, very precious and valuable. And he wanted to share that with others. But before I speak more, I would like to ask, just so I have an idea, could those of you who had either met Srila Tamal Krishna Goswami or seen him personally, perhaps giving a class or something, could you please raise your hand? Okay, so it's not the minority here. The Prabhupada had an instruction about how chutney should taste. Maybe many of you have heard this. He said that it should be too hot to handle, and, do you all know? Too sweet to resist. Too hot to handle, too sweet to resist. And this is also very applicable to my Guru Maharaj. This is what he was like. People that knew him, had his association, this is what it was like. He's known for his temper, but he was also known to be very soft and very sweet and very thoughtful and caring and loving. So both sides were there. He had many other facets to his personality as well. So I thought I would speak maybe a little bit about the hot and a little bit about the sweet and throw some other things in as well. But I'll start with the hot. Actually, before I do that, let me just describe just a bit. Maybe many people know something about his life, but I'll touch on something that maybe even those that know quite a bit may not have heard before. I grew up in New York City, and Sri Tirumal Krishna Goswami also grew up there. I know the apartment where he grew up as a boy. And he grew up in a neighborhood in Manhattan called Harlem. And how many of you have heard of Harlem before? Do you know? It's a famous neighborhood in New York, but it's known for being a very tough neighborhood, right? A ghetto. And mostly African Americans live there. And so he was a white American. So that made it even tougher to live in that neighborhood. And so he had quite a strong, I think it made him quite strong. At the same time, he had what they call, in America we have a term we call street smart. Do they have a term like that? In Hindi, perhaps? It means you're smart, not just academically, but you know how not to get cheated and how what is dangerous and what's not dangerous, and you know your way around the city very well. So he had this kind of street smarts. Also, his parents were not wealthy, but they were intellectuals. So he got from, his mother was quite an intellectual lady. His father was a labor leader, but also quite an intellectual. So he also had this intellectual side to his personality. And I think all of these created a very unique individual. And then when he was placed himself in the hands of Srila Prabhupada, I think he took that kind of intelligence that he had and he made it sharper and sharper and sharper and sharper. And he also instructed him a lot about, I think especially here, particularly probably in Mumbai, as well as throughout India, he learned a lot about, I think he learned a lot about the high class culture of India, and he absorbed a lot of that. So he also was very much like an aristocrat. So he had many aspects to his personality. But I'll start with some of the hot, because he didn't always have the stereotypical external presence of a sadhu. When we think of a sadhu, we think very humble and maybe quiet. And he had a particular personality, and what he did was he shared it, or he gave it to his guru and gave it to Krishna as it was, without change, but fully for Krishna's service. You found that? No. Try bittersweet. So I'll talk about the most angry I ever saw him in my entire life. And I saw him angry many, many times. Because if something wasn't right, if it wasn't done right, this anger would manifest. And this was a day in Dallas, Texas, in the temple there. He had a community that was largely his disciples there. And there are very beautiful deities there of Sri Sri Radha Kalachanji. And then there was also a very small set of deities there, the Vijay Murtis, they were made of marble. They were small. And in the Krishna deity, there was some defect. I believe that perhaps he had been chipped in some way, some time before. So the Radha and Krishna there were going to be replaced with metal deities. There was going to be a Prana Pratishtha ceremony. And Radharani was going to be brought to a disciple of his in Houston, about a 4-hour drive away. And Krishna was going to be brought to the Yamuna and dropped into the Yamuna. So this was the day of that Prana Pratishtha. So the metal deities were installed. And I was fortunate that although I saw him so angry, I was not directly responsible for what was wrong. So I was in the eye of the hurricane. There's great storm raging, but I was in a peaceful little area right in the middle of it. And after the deities were installed, he went around into the pujari room. And there he wanted to see how Radharani, that was going, the marble Radharani that was going to Houston, was being cared for. So he walked in there, and then he turned to the pujaris and he said, "So, what are you doing now with Radharani?" And one of the pujaris pointed to a box, a cardboard box. And inside that box is what they call, in America they have a term, they call it popcorn. But it's not real popcorn, it's like made out of styrofoam. And it's for when you have something that's breakable and you put it in a box, you have this styrofoam, little pieces of styrofoam. So this pujari pointed to this box with this styrofoam in it. And that's all it took. That was like lighting a flame to a bomb. He started screaming at the poor pujari who made this horrible mistake. But he said, actually it was a lady, very nice devotee, a South Indian Brahmin family. And he said, "You come from a South Indian Brahmin family and you're going to treat Radharani like she's some lamp?" In other words, just like some ceramic lamp or something. He was screaming at her and she was terrified. And then he turned around, the box was on the floor, and he kicked the box. And all this white styrofoam is flying all throughout the air. And I was just sitting there watching this whole thing go on. But I saw how furious he became when to see Radharani was being treated like that. He says, "Do you want to be put in that box? Is that how you want to be treated?" And it taught me a great lesson. I think it taught whoever there was a great lesson. The importance of that we never become complacent or... that we never forget that when we're dealing with Krishna or Radharani and the Archavigraha, this is not some piece of stone, that this is Krishna, this is Radharani. And I remember him immediately ordering them all to create some very nice kind of bed for her. And she was placed in that bed, and he took her out into the parking lot, placed her in a car, and as the car drove off, he was lying down full dandavat in this gravelly driveway to see her off. So when he showed that anger, it was a very frightening experience. And I'll repeat a story that I told the other day. I spoke with Bhagavatam class here, but it's a very instructive story, and most of you weren't here for that, so I'll tell it again. I used to stay with my Guru Maharaj, and he had a little home, a disciple of his had a little home in Vrindavan, just a block away from the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And I used to stay there with him, and one or two other disciples would be there. And he used to have very nice pastimes there with his godbrothers daily. Every day he would invite some Giriraj Swami or Shivaram Swami or so many others, friends of his, to come for breakfast and for lunch. And the disciples would prepare the meal, and he would share it with them. And one morning he asked another disciple, not myself, to go and invite the different people that he wanted to invite. And that disciple came back and told me that he invited so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and they're all coming, but Dhanadhar Swami won't be coming. So he just let me know that. So then later my Guru Maharaj called me into his room, and he said, "Who's coming to breakfast?" So I told him who was coming. I told him Dhanadhar Swami won't be making it. "Why not?" Now, I didn't even know why not. All I knew was that he wasn't coming. I wasn't even the person that went to ask him. I said, "I don't know, Gurudev." Then he became very angry. And he said, "This is the problem with all you disciples." And this is an important lesson. If you listen carefully, you can gain something valuable here. "This is the problem with all you disciples. You're like peons." So a peon is a servant that just does what you tell them, and then they don't have their own brain to work with so much. They just do what they're told and nothing more. And they probably don't do it very well. So he said, "You're like peons. You go and you do what I tell you to do, you come back." He said, "But what a real disciple does is they take the order of their spiritual master and they make the desire of their guru their own desire." Right. He says, "If you desired for Dhanadhar Swami to be at this meal as much as I did, he would be coming this morning." Now, I was thinking that I'm not the one that that even went to ask him. But I wasn't going to mention that because the anger would increase and this is the wrong strategy. So I just accepted what he was saying. I was actually very grateful for it and I tried to imbibe the message that he was being made. So he said, "Now you go to Dhanadhar Swami, you invite him again." So I said, "Okay." So I went and invited Dhanadhar Swami and he was happy to come. But I learned that was a very important lesson about how one deals with a guru. But we had actually a lot of wonderful times in that house. I was thinking of another time, and this shows a bit how he wanted the disciple to, he was very attentive to details. And he wanted the disciple to be very attentive and to listen very carefully to whatever was being said. So to understand this, you'll have to listen very carefully because it's a little tricky. But one morning, I would rise very early and be bathed and dressed before my guru would wake up. So he would call me into his room. He called me in. I forget what the subject was. We discussed a few things. And there was another godbrother of mine who was just waking up in another room. So he said, and I have to think carefully. He said, after that disciple is done bathing, tell him to come and see me. I said, yes, Gurudev. So I walked out and I went to the other room where the other disciple was just waking up. And he said, so what happened? It was always like that. What happened? What did he say? So he said, what did he say? And I said, he said that when you're done bathing, you should go see him. And then I left. So then later on, I get called into my Guru Maharaj's room. And he said, what did I tell you? I said that you told me that I should tell him that when he's done bathing, he should go see you. He said, that's not what I told you. I was sure that that's what he told me. He said, I didn't tell you to tell him that when he was done bathing to come see me. I told you that when he is done bathing, tell him to come see me. You see the difference? When he's done bathing, then I'm supposed to tell him. I don't tell him before he's bathing. When he's done bathing, tell him to come see me. It seems just a little different, but it's very different. He said, because I knew that he's so passionate that as soon as he hears, he's going to come running in here and he's not bathed, he's not clean. I don't want to see him when he's all in tamasic like that. So you had to listen very carefully. But I'll repeat one other story that took place in the same home, because again, it's instructive. And I mentioned this also earlier in the week, but I'll repeat it. The first time I went to Vrindavan, I was with one very nice sannyasi, Gunagrahi Maharaj. Maybe, I don't know if he's ever come. He's probably come here before. And I was very new brahmacharya. I was serving him. And my Guru Maharaj had other more senior disciples serving him in the home that he was staying in. So one day I was with my Guru Maharaj and he said to me, Gunagrahi Maharaj says you're serving him nicely. And I said, yes, thank you, Gurudev. But Gunagrahi Maharaj is very easy to please. Very easy person to please. Now, it's a fact, not that I necessarily intentionally meant it, but there is something implicit in that statement. That is, he's very easy to please, but Srila Gurudev, you're a very difficult person to please. Because he's so, every detail had to be perfect. So I said, yes, Gurudev, but Gunagrahi Maharaj is a very easy person to please. And then again, he gave me that stare, very sharp. And he said, I am also very easy to please. He said, I am also very easy. And I can remember this so clearly. Your heart is just feeling like it weighs a ton and the instruction's coming and you're feeling like this is one of the most significant moments in my life. You're feeling like that when he would speak. He had the presence. I said he was like an aristocrat. He was. But he just had a very powerful presence. Some people just have that. So when you're around him, you felt, I'm dealing with someone very important. And when he gave you that stare, then it increased 10 times. So he said, yes, I'm also very easy to please. You just have to have the right disposition. Right? So the right disposition means you have to have the right attitude, I'm trying to think of the exact translation, but disposition, it means you have the right attitude. So what does that mean? That's something I've thought a lot about over the years. What is the right disposition? But I think part of it with him meant that you're selfless. You gave up desires for your own comforts and your own pleasures, and you gave yourself entirely to the guru. Right? Not just your body and not just you'll do what he says, but you really give yourself to him to the point where you're not concerned about yourself. You're only concerned about pleasing the guru. That becomes your only purpose in life. And he could demand that because he lived that himself. And because he lived that himself, he gained such experience from Srila Prabhupada. He absorbed it like a sponge. And I remember once, again, I was very new to devotional service, and he was giving a class, and it was before mostly his disciples. And he said this. He said, Srila Prabhupada gave me so much. Because he had so much time with Prabhupada. Very few disciples had as much personal time with Prabhupada. And Prabhupada entrusted him with many things. So he said, Prabhupada gave me so much. And he says, and I want to share all that he gave me with all of my disciples. And if they're willing to come close enough, I will share all that I can. Because many disciples were afraid to come too close. As a fact, it was frightening. I tell you, the anger was, when he became angry, it was very, very, it really was painful and frightening. So he had that very hot side. But he also had the very, very, very sweet side. And this is what completes his personality. But actually, before I want to talk about that sweet side, I will talk a little bit about his intelligence. He had some very special transcendental intelligence. He was very much a genius. And I think that is probably why Prabhupada took him so close in the beginning. And he saw something special. Brain is here. We have many IIT graduates here in this congregation and amongst the brahmacharis. I offer my obeisances to you. They barely let me out of school. I think I wasn't even qualified to graduate, but they didn't want me around anymore, so they gave me a diploma and they said go. But my Guru Maharaj, when he was a young man, he began the university, but he quickly gave that up, feeling there's no true purpose. I'm not finding the purpose of life here. And he went off in search of that, and he found that with Srila Prabhupada. But at a certain point, I believe it was 1994, to serve Srila Prabhupada, he went back to the university to work on a PhD in religious studies. So he went to a university in Dallas, Texas called Southern Methodist University. And Southern Methodist University is a very prestigious school. It's been around for nearly a century, and it's in that area of the country is considered, in America they have a term, Ivy League, which is like Yale, Harvard, Princeton, very old schools, old for America, Brown University. So SMU is like the Ivy League school, the very respected university in that part of the country. And it has a history of students. I think it probably has about, my guess is 15,000 students per year, and that's for nearly 100 years. Now, he went back into that school, and they didn't say, oh, Goswami Maharaj, you've come, we're going to give you special treatment. They treated him just like any other student there, and he had to start right from the beginning. And in the course of his 3 years that he spent there, he became very decorated. He won many awards for papers that he wrote and so on. And then in his senior year, he won a very special award. And when I think about him winning this award, I think about Mahabharata, where we hear about Dronacharya, and he's training the Pandavas and the Kauravas when they're young. And we know that story when he puts this wooden bird up in the tree, right? And he's calling the different disciples to come, and what do you see? And they say, I see the tree, and I see the sky, and I see the bird, and get out of here. Next one, also wrong. Next one, also wrong. Then Arjuna, tell me what you see. I see the bird. Describe the bird. I only see its eye, the fire. You know. So the kind of focused intelligence that he had, it reminds me of this, because, like I say, there are maybe 15,000 students per year, nearly 100 years of this school. So many, many, many thousands of students went through this prestigious school, which is a very difficult school just to get in the first place. The most prestigious award that they give to a student there is called the Senior Student Award. It means in your senior year, the professors get together and they choose who is the top student amongst the entire senior class. He won that award. Okay. So that's a very special award to win. But one person wins it every year, so there are nearly 100 people that won that award previously. But in the entire history of the school, he was the only person to win that award unanimously. every single professor that voted who should win the award voted for him. So amongst thousands and thousands of students, he focused and became the top student in the history of the entire university. That was Srila Tamalakrishna Goswami. That's how he served his guru, with that kind of expertise, with that kind of intelligence, with that kind of determination. And he did this. Most of the students that go to that school do it, and they have one thing in their life that they're doing. They're studying. He had so many things that he was doing. He was GBC for so many different places. He was responsible for preaching in China and other places around the world. He had nearly 1,000 disciples. And he had many other people in ISKCON that were constantly calling him, writing him emails, writing him letters, asking for advice. He was responsible for big projects in different parts of the world. He had so many things he was doing. At the same time, he became the most, very topmost decorated student in the history of this prestigious school. So that's how special, unique he was, and how empowered he was. Right? He was doing it for Srila Prabhupada. And he wanted nothing. He knew he was Srila Prabhupada's one representative in the university, and he wanted to be the best for Srila Prabhupada. And then he also, some unique things happened when he was in the university. Every year, there's a conference among the professors. They get together, and students also attend. And it's called the American Academy of Religions. They have it in a different city every year. Mostly, very well-respected professors deliver papers. They give their speeches at these conferences. Every now and then, someone with a PhD that isn't a professor will speak. Never will you hear from just a graduate student. What to speak of an undergraduate student. But his papers were so, I guess there's such great scholarship there. And as a person, he was so fascinating that he was delivering papers right from the beginning as an undergraduate student at these big conferences and creating quite a sensation, actually. And I thought I'd tell one story about how, again, it's about his intelligence and his sensitivity. He had one professor there that became his mentor as a scholar. And my Guru Maharaj was delivering a paper. And at the end of that, he was taking questions. So his mentor decided that he would ask a question, but in a sense test him, give him a very difficult challenge. So he asked a question, and the question was this. He said, "To understand the Srimad Bhagavatam, do you have to be a devotee of Krishna?" Okay. In one sense, it sounds like a simple enough question. Most of us would say, yes, you do. Says it right there. In the Gita, we'll find verses and so on. To understand this message, you have to be a devotee. But amongst these scholars, to say that would not have been a very satisfying answer for them. And immediately they would have put him in a box, a very category that this person, they have their terms for this type of thinking, and it's not appreciated, right? And if he spoke there and he was not appreciated, it would hinder his service in the future. He wouldn't be asked to speak, perhaps, in the future. And he wouldn't be taken as seriously as a representative of Srila Prabhupada. So he had a very difficult situation. Is he going to misrepresent our teachings to please these people? Or is he going to tell the truth according to our understanding and turn off all these people and make them upset? So this was his answer. The person asked, and this was his mentor, and they became quite close. And the mentor asked, "Do you need to be a devotee of Krishna to understand the Srimad Bhagavatam and its teachings?" And his answer was, he said, "No, because you have me as a friend." Right? So now, if you look at this answer and you think about it, it's very clever and it's very perfect and it accomplishes many things at one time, right? On one hand, the people get the answer that they want. You do not need to be a devotee of Krishna to understand the Bhagavatam's message. At the same time, he tells the truth. Unless you go to devotee, you're not going to understand this, right? You can't understand it just through academic study, right? And on top of that, he warmed the hearts of all the people there, particularly his professor, by saying, because you have me as a friend, right? It's not that I'm just here to preach to you, or it's not that I'm just here to get something from you that I can go out into the world and use it. But I'm developing a loving relationship with you as well. I appreciate you. I value you. I consider you my friend. You see me as your friend. I see you as... So he did all... He accomplished all these things at one time with this very clever answer. And afterward, his professor went up to him and he said... Now, this is I'm going to use an American sporting term because this is what he used. In baseball, some of you may know it, it's similar to cricket. When they throw the ball, then you have to hit it. Something like cricket. In cricket, I don't know, but when they throw the ball, can they make it spin in different ways? Yes? Okay. So in baseball, they also, when the pitcher throws the ball, he can make it spin. And when it comes at you, it's going curving. And they have different types of pitches like this, and one is called the curve ball. So you throw it and it makes a big curve and very difficult to hit. So he said, and the idea is that when you hit the ball, the best thing you can do is you hit it out, is it also in cricket? You hit it out of the park, they say, right? So he said, I threw you, the mentor went up to him and said, I threw you a curve ball, but you hit it out of the park. So he was very, very intelligent and very, very sensitive. And I'll mention one more time that he answered a question like this. It was at a Sunday feast program like we have here today in Brooklyn, New York, Sri Sri Radha Govinda Mandir. And here you all come and you know who Krishna is and who Prabhupada is. And there, many people have no idea. And they have never been in, sometimes people come, they've never been in a temple ever in their entire life. So he was giving his discourse, and at the end, one person asked a question, and this person was obviously their very first time coming to a temple. And they pointed to Srila Prabhupada. And the person asked, why is that man not moving and has not said anything? Now, you can answer that question in many ways. Most people would immediately say, that is a Murti, that is not actually a real person, that is... But actually, if you answer like that, it's true and it's not true, right? And it's not so pleasing to the devotees to even hear it spoke, to hear Srila Prabhupada spoken in that way, right? It's not pleasant to the ear, to the heart. And also, if he were to say, that's not a person, that is a statue. Also, that person would be embarrassed. They'd be like, oh, I didn't know. They might feel somewhat embarrassed, right? So what he said is, the person says, why is that person sitting there and not saying anything, not moving? He said, he is teaching us many things. He's teaching us patience and stillness and you know, Mona. So he said a few things, but he is teaching us this, you know. He's teaching us patience, I think is what he said. So in this way, the person was not embarrassed. And all the devotees, it was like a very pleasant shower of flowers comes down. It was that kind of moment. You know, it's like, very nice. You know, everyone was very... very pleased and very satisfied with that answer. So he could, when he was put under pressure, he would always come through in a very unique and very intelligent way. So he was intelligent, he was sensitive. And that sensitivity is part of what made him so sweet. I said I would speak about him being sweet. He could get right into a person's heart like no one else. It was quite... Particularly if he wanted to make you his friend, he would find a way to get right into your heart. And also with his disciples, in many ways, he would take a person that wasn't sure about Krishna consciousness. He would get so tight with them that they had to surrender to Krishna. In so many ways, I saw this. When he passed away, so many devotees spoke up about the effect that he had on their life. And from so many, it was so many hundreds and thousands of people, it's really quite amazing how he was so sweet that he could really work his way into your life. I'll tell one quick story involving my wife. Because when we got married, he had not yet met her. He had heard many nice things about her, but he had not yet met her. And again, part of what, like showing that he got so much from Prabhupada and he wanted to give it. He said, my wife is a disciple of Srila Niranjan Swami. So he said, it's not important to me that this girl be my disciple. But what is important to me is that if she can accept what I have to give to her. Right? Otherwise, what is the point? He said, I have so much that I want to give. If she's willing to accept that, then it'll be a very nice relationship. So when we're getting married, when most girls are getting married, just in the days before, they may be very nervous because of the marriage and so many details and lifelong commitment and all the wedding things that are going on. But my wife wasn't nervous at all about the wedding. She was only nervous because she had to meet Srila Tamal Krishna Goswami. And this was very frightening to her, and she didn't know what was going to happen and so on. But when we got together, he had a way of making her feel very comfortable with his words. And it wasn't the first time that they met, but the second time that they met, we were in a very open area on a lawn, and we were walking towards him, and he was walking towards us. So then when he got up to us, we offered obeisances, we stood up. And he said something to my wife, and my wife answered back. I have something very simple. Hello, how are you doing? We're doing very fine. How are you, Maharaj? Something like that. And my wife has a British accent. So when he heard her speak, he said, oh, what a nice accent. Then he turned to me and said, you could have married her just for the accent alone. But as soon as he would say something like that, immediately the heart would melt and everyone would feel very comfortable like that. And he could say many, many very sweet things. One other, I tell you, I've heard many people glorify my Guru Maharaj, but they've never mentioned this one point that I will mention that I think is unique. But when I mentioned it, many people that had experienced it say, yes, that's true. But if anyone here had ever had the benediction to be embraced by him, he smelled just very, very beautiful. I don't know how to describe it. He just had a very, very, it was like something like flowers or camphor. Something about him smelled very pure. And I thought about this a lot because often I would collect his laundry too. Maybe Hari Bolananda collected his laundry before. And it didn't matter if it was a very hot day, sweaty day, anything. You collect and it also had that smell. And he wasn't wearing any kind of perfume or cologne or somehow when you, it was just like flowers. And he smelled so, so fresh and sweet. And anyone that's, when I mention that to people, they say, yes, that's true. But somehow that was there. I don't know what made it that way. But although he was very heavy, he was very sweet, and he would do things to arrange intimacy with another person. Right? When two people are put in a particular position, that the situation can be positive or negative towards intimacy or to closeness, to friendship. Right? Just like the Goswamis have written so many books, and they describe different circumstances. Right, when Radha and Krishna are together, if these gopis are there, then this kind of emotion can happen. And if these residents of Vrindavan are there, then that restricts that. And in different ways, he had some understanding of this. And often he would create a circumstance by which people would open up to one another in a more deep way than they would under other circumstances. And he did that with me quite a few times. I was fortunate somehow to spend a lot of time with him. I was... He didn't have too many brahmachari disciples. And in America, I was the senior brahmachari disciple. And I also grew up in the same place where he grew up. So I think somehow he took me a little bit in and was a little bit like a, treated me a little bit like a son or like a pet in a way, which I was very happy about that. And so I would often stay with him. So, and often he had trouble sleeping. This was a common problem that he had. He was often awake in the middle of the night. Now, many people, if they would woken up in the middle of the night, they would just maybe get up and do something, or they would just try to roll over and go back to sleep. But many times, he would call me into his room at 12 o'clock midnight or at 1 in the morning. Did this happen? This happened. I remember your story. Yes, this happened to you too. Hari Bolananda Prabhu served him one time here in Mumbai. And he would call me into the room, and different things would happen. Sometimes he would say, I'm having a hard time sleeping. I feel a lot of heat in my legs. He said, let me feel your hands. And then he would take my hand in his hands. And he would, when you take someone's hand in your hand, it's an intimate thing. And he would feel my hand. And he'd say, okay, your hands are cool. Very good. give my legs a massage. You know, so then I'd be massaging his legs. And it's totally dark. Can't even see him. He can't even see me, but we're talking. And I'd be massaging his legs, and we'd be talking. We'd talk about so many things. We'd talk about his childhood or my childhood or so many different just personal things. But when he would do this, it would affect your heart that he would take that time and spend that time in that very special way with you. And he did that at so many times and in so many different ways. I also remember one time I had just become a Sankirtan leader after just a couple years of being a book distributor. And we were going to have our marathon in December. And I got a phone call from one of my godbrothers saying that Gurudev is going to be in New York. He's coming through New York, and if you can be there, he would like to see you there. And I gave back the message that I'm in charge of a party of maybe 25 book distributors, and we're all in this one place, and there's no way that I can go to see him. But if he would like to come see all of us, we'd be very happy if he'd come to see us. So this was in Atlanta, Georgia, in America. So he came to see us. And this was my first time that I had no godbrothers there, no godsisters there. I was serving him all alone. And we stayed in one place together. And I was responsible for taking care of him. And I went through quite some hot and sweet at that time too. But I remember I had to walk him to it was winter, there was snow and ice, and there was some hills we had to walk down. And at that time I said, Gurudev, be very careful walking down this hill. It was dark and it was very slippery. And at that time he said, give me your hand. And this is the first time he'd done such an intimate thing. He said, give me your hand. And he took my hand and it's his. And again, when he'd take your hand, he'd take it in a very special way and he'd feel it and hold it. And I just remember feeling very close to him at that time. And he gave very many really wonderful lectures. And then that evening, I was wondering, is he going to want to eat? And I was asking him beforehand, before he was going to speak, do you want to eat? Do you want some dinner, Gurudev? Don't worry about that. I said, okay. But then after the class, it was very late at night, and he said, okay, I want something to eat. And I was like, now what am I going to do? And he said, what do you have arranged? And earlier I could have arranged something, but now I didn't know what I could do. So I felt the temperature rising. Step by step, what are you going to do? Well, Gurudev, what are you going to do? It's going up each level. And then he said, I forget what happened. He said, well, why don't you have something for me? You should have some milk and some puris or something. I said, I can make puris for you, Gurudev. I can have that for you. And, he says, how long will you take to make the puris? It's 10 minutes. He said, okay, 10 minutes, go. Now you can be certain if I came in at 10 and a half minutes, I would have been hearing about it. Somehow I was saved because I spoke that. I just said 10 minutes because I was under pressure. I didn't know where any flour was, where any ghee was. It would have probably taken me at least a half an hour, and then it would have really been bad. Right then, some very nice Mataji came in and said, Gurudev, would you like something to eat? We have so much for you. And I was saved. But I would have been in big trouble. But actually you learn, you see, he would train you that you don't open your mouth and say stupid things, actually, that every word that come out of your mouth, it better be meaning behind it and substance behind it. Otherwise, he wouldn't let you get away. Even sometimes, and this is some special mercy he gave to me. He gave different disciples and different devotees mercy in different ways, and he did something very special for me. And that is, while he was in college in Texas, it was a good 3 or 4 years that he spent there. I was on traveling Sankirtan, but as much time as I could, I would do Sankirtan in the area where he was so I can spend time with him in the mornings. And so many, many mornings, I would chant my japa with him. He would sit in the temple room, and he had one place he would always sit. And then he had one place next to him, and that was for me. And if anyone else tried to sit there, he would say no. And then he would let me come sit there. It's not that I'm something special, but that was one special thing he did for me. And we would chant our japa together, so I had that mercy to chant right next to him. And then towards the end of when we were done, there would always be some discussion. And he would ask me questions. And I know what he was doing at that time was, it wasn't just that he was talking. He was trying to fix my brain, right? Take it from its very poor state that it's in and try to train it to think properly. And so he'd ask me questions. And the questions, when I would answer the question, he was going to respond to my answer. So I would have to think carefully about my answers. I couldn't, and he might say something like, what do you think about what so-and-so Maharaj is doing in this place? And, you know, we love the devotees, and we'd normally want to say, oh, it's wonderful what he's doing, Gurudev. All glories to that Maharaj. And he didn't want to hear just necessarily that. If I would say that, okay, that's fine. Why? Why is what he's doing special? Yeah. And then I would have to answer. And I couldn't just come say, because it's ecstatic, and he's spreading the glories of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That wasn't it said. He wanted to know specifically what was it about it that was special, unique, or why am I saying what I said? And day after day after day, this would happen. And I saw that what he was trying to do is take my brain and make it think and see things that other people weren't seeing and think in ways that other people weren't thinking, try to lift it up out of the mud that it's in and try to get it sharpened, right? So he gave me that special mercy like that. And every day I would be sitting there with him. But there are a lot of wonderful pastimes that we had there in Dallas. And some more of them were, many of you may know, maybe 2 years before he passed away, he got cancer. And he had an operation to remove the cancer. And I wasn't with him when he had the operation, but I was in India. And I returned back, and he was recuperating. He was almost done recuperating. He had maybe a week or two to go before he was supposed to be back to full strength. And then he was going to return to England, where he was going to Cambridge University. So when I returned, he said to me, normally I would immediately go right back out to distribute books. I go traveling. And he said to me, just stay around. He says, I don't even mind. Don't worry about selling books. Just stay here and just, you know, be around me. So again, sometimes I say he treated me like a pet. So I was very happy. Okay, Gurudev, of course, I'll stay with you. I'm happy to stay with you. But after 1 week, complications developed. And this is interesting too, because a lot about his character comes through in this. It was some very horrible things went on with his body because the doctor made a mistake. And this is one story. They went to the very best surgeon in Dallas, Texas. Highly recommended, very expensive. And in the course of the operation that had to be done, one tube had to be cut and then put and stapled together for the course of the operation. Then they removed the staple, they put back together, and you should be as good as new. But he was feeling pain in his kidney, and he knew something was wrong. And it increased and increased and increased. So they're asking the doctor, what has gone wrong? And the doctor's saying, it may be this, it may be that. It's not a big thing. We'll take care of this. Don't worry about it. But it increased and it got more and more. And he had one disciple that was a surgical nurse. So he said, what is going on here? And the surgical nurse said, there's a possibility that they left that tube and you stapled. So it's shut. And if that happens, there's no flow to the kidney. And the kidney turns like crystal and hardens, and you can lose the kidney. So this was obviously a great concern. And he had to go to the hospital to try to deal with this, and he was lying in his hospital bed. But the problem was the doctor did not want to admit that this was a possibility. Right. So meanwhile, he's going through all these difficult procedures, but the doctor's not getting right to the point that probably the problem is you made a big mistake. So he had to find out. And he wasn't getting it from the doctor. So this is the way that he did it. I was in the room for the first part of this, but not for the second part. But I knew what he was doing because I caught on from the beginning. So the doctor walked into the room. Now, if he was to ask the doctor directly, did you make this mistake? Then the doctor might immediately make some excuse. He didn't want that. So he wanted to really try to understand what was going on in the doctor's mind, what was going on in the doctor's heart. So when the doctor walked in, he greeted him very nicely. Oh, very nice to see you. Good morning. He said, you know, last night I had the most amazing dream. And the doctor was like, okay. So then what he did, I wasn't there, but I understood what he did. Then what he did was he said to the doctor, I dreamt that you left this staple in me. And then he would look at the doctor's face. And all that he would have to know would be written on the doctor's face. Right? This is how he's very clever like this. And so immediately he got a feeling from this doctor that he didn't like. They went to the next doctor. They found out that it was stapled just like they had thought. And they removed that. That's also part of when I say he was street smart. You know, he could do things. He would find a way to get the job done. But I was serving him at that time that he was recuperating. And it was a very difficult time because he had one catheter coming out of his kidney. And when he needed that no longer, they left the, not the bag that comes from the catheter, but they left the plug back there just in case he would need it again. And then after they made this other mistake, he needed another catheter coming out the bladder. So it's very uncomfortable. And on top of that, there are many other kinds of discomforts. He had lost weight and he was looking very weak from all of this surgery, and it was a very difficult time. And I would have to, whenever he would get up, I would have to help lift him and lift this bag that was coming from, because it was very, very, very painful. And I would have to where I'd have to go, I'd have to walk with him, and I'd have to bathe him, because he couldn't, because they had these taps coming out of you, and they're taped on, and if you bathe, then they can fall off, and then they have a very big problem. So he had to bathe with, you know, this antiseptic kind of gel. He'd have to use that, and I could bathe him with his wet, damp sponge, and just, and I would bathe his entire body. And he would say, how do you like this service? Every morning I'd bathe him. He'd be standing there before me, and I'd be bathing him. He'd say, how do you like this service, Kastuba? And I'd say, oh, I like it very much, Gurudev. It's just like deity worship. And he'd say, I said the exact same thing to Srila Prabhupada, because he was doing the same kind of service for Prabhupada. And, but what I, one picture that I have in mind always very clearly is how humble he could be. Whatever he did it with gusto, right, with power. So when he displays humility, he also did it with power. And I just always remember that he was very weak and he had this bag coming out of his front. But every day he wanted to go see Sri Sri Radha Kalachanji. And for someone that's honored, and he always was very classy and always looked very nice, and to be seen like this, they don't want to be seen like this. But he wanted to see the deity. So every morning he would get up, he would take that bag, and he'd put it inside a handbag. And he was very weak, and he'd walk with a cane, and he'd go very, very weakly down, and he'd offer his obeisances to the deity, spend a little time, and come back up. It was a very heart-rendering time. But, and I remember, because he would normally have difficulty sleeping, and especially at this time, and I would be in the room with him. I have 10 minutes left, is that correct? Yeah. I'd be in the room outside his room, and he had a buzzer. When he wanted to call the disciples, or you'd hit it, it was an eh. It was very loud. It was very scary. And when the buzzer goes, your heart is like, oh. And then you try to calm down, and then you go into the room. And one time, one of the disciples changed the buzzer so that when he hit the button, go ding dong. He immediately said, change it back. And he would ring that bell sometimes 4 or 5 times a night. So I would have to get up. I'd go to bed after him. I'd have to get up well before him. So I would have maybe 4 or 5 hours in which to sleep, and I might be interrupted 3, 4, 5 times in the middle of the night with his buzzer. So I was becoming very weak. I had no appetite. I was really... But he was such a high-powered person that I was looking a mess. I look skinny now. I was down. I was much, much... I'd lost maybe 15 pounds. I was really thin, and people were looking at me and saying, oh, boy, you look really bad. But he was so high-powered, he didn't even notice. I remember one morning I was trying to go off to get some sleep, and he had one very nice disciple, Kirtida, who was this surgical nurse, and she said, go, just go and sleep and rest. And just as about to go, he walked in, and he said, where are you going? He said, he's going to take some rest, Gurudev. Why do you need rest? Like that. That was the way he was. But we had very sweet times at that time, too, because he left the world so quickly that we didn't have, like with Prabhupada, many past times of his passing away. But we had something a little like it when he was recuperating from this surgery. he would lie in his bed and he would call his disciples and we'd have nice kirtan and we'd be reading and he was being very kind and giving benedictions and it was a really wonderful and sweet time. I thought I'd just talk one more thing because there's not so much time, but some of the sweetest times are on this Navadvip Mandala Parikrama. Many of you have probably been on that. And especially, I think it was in the years 93, 94, maybe 95, particularly all the GBC when everyone was going on this. And there were amazing kirtans, and the feasts were just unbelievable. And everyone, it seems somehow at that time, had you been on those? I'm sure many of the brahmacharis here had been on those. Seemed like Mahaprabhu's mercy was just showering on the whole movement, and it was great. It was just wonderful, wonderful time. And I got to be a servant on those. And he would tell me right at the beginning, he'd give me his bag and say, "This is my bag. You carry this, and you stay right next to me, and you never go anywhere," like that. But it was a wonderful instruction to get because you knew you were going to get a lot of mercy. And I remember one of those years I had arrived from Germany, and this shows the kind of detail that he appreciated. Once I did something nice for him, I remember in 1988, he was in New York. I have one friend there, Yogya Purusha Prabhu, who many of you know, all the brahmacharis know. Big, tall German devotee. So my Guru Maharaj was talking to him about Germany and said, there they have one very nice sweet, they call it nougat, that they make out of ground almonds, and it's very sweet and very delicious. I just remember him mentioning something about that sweet to my friend. So years later, 1994, I was in Germany. So this is 6 years later. And I was going to go meet my Guru Maharaj on this Navadvip Mandala Parikrama. So I asked around, I said, "Do any devotees make this sweet?" And they managed to find someone who could make it, and they shipped it to me, and I had it frozen, and then I managed to keep it cool the whole way to Bengal, and I put it in the refrigerator there. And then I went out to meet him in the morning. It was after the first night, so he was in a tent with Shivaram Swami, who also somehow, I didn't know at the time, but he also very much likes this sweet. So I showed up, and right when he was taking breakfast, so whoever was serving him right then, I said, "Here, give Gurudev some of these sweets." So then when he came out, he just had a big smile on his face. And he said to Shivaram Swami, he said, "Shivaram Swami, this is Kostubha Das, and he brought those sweets." He said, "Oh." He said, "You should thank him. He brought those sweets." He said, "Thank you very much." And then we started walking on the parikrama, and he turned to me and said, "Where did you get that sweet?" I said, "Well, you know, Gurudev, I just came from Germany, and they make that in Germany." And he said, "Well, how did you know I like it?" I said, "I just remember one time back in 88, you said to Yogi Purush that you liked that sweet." And he was really, that's the kind of thing that I remembered that he liked that sweet, and I went and got it. See, to him that meant that you're taking your guru's desire and you made it your own desire, right? Because in one sense, I could have easily just forgotten that. But the fact that he remembered, to him, that kind of thing, not just sweet little things. He wanted you to do hard kind of surrender too. But that indicated the kind of devotion that he wanted, that he saw we're meant to serve Krishna with, that we care about the details. So anyway, not that I did anything very special, but he liked that. And I remember on that parikrama, one of the most important features about him, and this again is a very important lesson, he loved his godbrothers. And he took advice from them. He would take orders from them. And he considered their opinion and their blessings very important in everything that he did. And he considered their friendship to be one of the most important aspects of his practice of bhakti. And so he had many friends and he had very close relationships with them. And it was really manifest on that parikrama more than anywhere. It was so nice. And I remember this was important. At the end of the parikrama, you all end up back at the yoga peet. And there are different devotees would speak, and they speak the realization about what had happened on this parikrama and why it was special. And I was sitting right next to him, right next to my Guru Maharaj. And Rabindra Swarup Prabhu was speaking. And Rabindra Swarup Prabhu said, and it's funny, but it's instructive. He said, "Many times, you know, I think of Prabhupada's statement, and he said that we'll have one big ISKCON back all together in the spiritual world. And he said, when I think about all the struggles we go through in ISKCON and all the difficulty we have with the relationships and there's so much that he has to go through, he said, sometimes when I hear that, it makes me worry that we're going to have this ISKCON back in the spiritual world." He said, but now that I've been on this Navadvip Mandal Prakrama and I've seen ISKCON under this light and I've relished it so much and I've gained so much from it, he said, now I understand what it means and what Sankirtan means. And what Sankirtan means is that we all go back to Godhead together as one group. Right? It's a very nice realization. And as soon as he said that, my Guru Maharaj turned around and he said, that's the point. That is the point right there. He said that was the point that he appreciated more than any. That, and I think it exemplifies a lot about how my Guru Maharaj lived and how he saw his service and how he saw the practice of bhakti, right? My Guru Maharaj had so many relationships with so many people. He was very hot. And often he would rub devotees the wrong way. Devotees would become very upset with him. He would become very upset with other devotees. A lot of tension. But somehow beyond that all, he understood that we're all servants of Srila Prabhupada. And even if he could see, even if there are things about another devotee that he didn't like and that other devotee had things about him that they didn't like, at the same time, he had the ability to see all the good in that person. And still so therefore he valued that person's association. And I remember there's one godbrother who, my Guru Maharaj could be very controversial, and there are many things he did throughout the history. He made mistakes. He learned from the mistakes. Some people, it upset them. And one person said to him, is that you've caused so much trouble for us in this movement throughout the years. He said, I will not trust you until you've gone another 10 years and without causing such a disturbance again. And he said, you know what? It's true. I have caused a lot of troubles. He said, but many of my godbrothers, even though I caused all these troubles, they love me anyway for who I am. Somehow they've seen some good in me. This was his answer. And he said, do you think you could do that also? And he said, what do you think Srila Prabhupada would want you to do? So I think this was the most important thing to him. He said, we're all followers of Srila Prabhupada. And we're all meant to serve him to whatever capacity we can. And we should be very dedicated and very devoted. And we should give our lives to Srila Prabhupada's mission. And we should understand that there's going to be bumps on the way. And we should learn to tolerate that. And we should learn from our mistakes. And we should appreciate all the devotees to whatever level that we can. And together as one group, we should all return to Prabhupada's lotus feet and return back to Godhead and serve them there. So I'll stop here. Thank you all so much for listening. I feel very honored to speak before all of you. And I see that one very great soul in the back who had a lot of personal association with my Guru Maharaj is raising his hand there. Mahaprabhu, Prabhu, please say something. Okay. Microphone is coming. Because I want to hear very carefully everything you say, because I know it will be very valuable. He's the person that served my Guru Maharaj, really served him, did the difficult things. I did little things. He did great things.
I was very lucky, actually, to have his association. I think I'm the only person in India who has got the maximum association of Maharaj in India. And he really... I don't know how he has so much faith. He was writing letters to the GBC in Bombay saying, if you can't do this thing, just pass on these papers to Mahaprabhu and you'll get the things done and you don't bother. So that's one thing. I'm not on that. I have several times met him in this Govardhan things and several things about Giriraj Maharaj in several meetings with him. But one, I want you to reply one question. You know, at his disappearance day time, your god brother came to New Vrindavan and he was giving history of how he filed a case against ISKCON and how Maharaj said that, and he became his disciple. Will you please, can you tell us something? It's a very important matter.
Oh, this is interesting. Unfortunately, I don't know all the details as exactly as I should, but I'll say what I can. And you were talking about one very nice godbrother, my Nityananda Prabhu, who is the temple president in Dallas, Texas.
Correct.
He's from Fiji.
Yeah.
He's from a very influential family in Fiji. And he grew. He was a lawyer. I believe he was from a family of lawyers. And he lived right next door to our temple in Fiji. And he did not like the temple being next door very much at all, because there was noise coming. He thought it was noise. Kirtan coming early in the morning, and at times he didn't want to hear it. And for whatever reasons, he was very disturbed, very upset, did not like these devotees being there at all. And he filed a lawsuit to shut this down or to make a silence. There must be silence. I don't know. Maybe you know more detail exactly what the lawsuit was about, but there's something along this. He wanted to shut this temple down, cut it off. And so he was very angry too. He's a powerful individual. So when he gets angry, he gets upset, he becomes very strong. He's ready to do whatever. He'll build an army and he'll do whatever it takes to get the job done. So this man was very angry, very disturbed, and very determined. So my Guru Maharaj said, bring him to me. And so they brought him to him. And then he said, and I don't know, I wish I knew more, because actually when you hear the whole story and all the details, it's very wonderful. I know some details. But he said to him, so what is the difficulty here? And the man said, you're hearing this noise, nobody can sleep, you're making all this racket. I have important things to do in my life, I have a busy schedule and so many important things. You people are all lazy and you're just making noise, you're not doing anything valuable for the world, and I have so many things that I have to do and you're disturbing that. Something like this. So he said, tell me your schedule. When do you wake up? I wake up at this time. And then what do you do? And then he got this person to give him his entire schedule from when the minute he woke up to the minute that he went to sleep. He said, okay, if you have so many things to do and you want to be more efficient, you feel we're interfering, let me tell you, this is how you should organize your day. First of all, you should do this, and then you should do that. And what you're doing here, this is a waste of time. You should be doing this and it and that and the other. And he completely reorganized this man's schedule. Now, this man was expecting he's going to come there and there's going to be some fight and some argument and so on. He got something very different. Suddenly, this man is telling him how he should live his life and reorganize his whole, manage his whole life in a completely different way. But he spoke so powerfully and so intelligently, so clearly that the man was like, it really was making quite sense. And so I don't know if it was at that point, but it was probably some point later when he put this into practice and began to feel some good result coming from it, that the man began to, the Nityananda Prabhu, he began to associate with the devotees, and then he gave him this kind of ultimatum that he often did. Because, you know, my Guru Maharaj made many people devotees, and often, especially back in the 70s, it was done on the spot. Because there are many people that were sitting on the fence, they had some appreciation. And when he was traveling with this Radha Damodar party, they say Vishnu Jan was the sweet and he was the heavy, right? So Vishnu Jan Maharaj would chant very beautiful kirtan and he would speak to this person and convince them that right now you should give up everything you have going in your life. You should get on this bus with us and you should surrender your entire life to Krishna now. And they went from city to city to city, and many people did this. So at a certain and what he would do is he'd say, I'm only interested in getting to know and serve and love God, and I want it to happen as soon as possible. Do you feel the same way? And they goes, yes, that's all I want. He'd say, okay. So then I'll tell you about what I'm doing, and you tell me what you're doing. And if what I'm doing is better than what you're doing, or he'd say, if what you're doing makes more sense and I feel that I can come to God more quickly through that, then I will give up what I'm doing right now. I'm not attached to this shaved head and robes and so on. I'll do exactly what you're doing and I'll follow you. But if what I say makes more sense than what you say, then you should be willing to give up everything that you're doing right now, come shave your head, put on these robes and follow me. And at that time, people were very concerned. It was a time in America where people were looking for the truth and willing to, and the integrity was very important. So they say, okay, if that's the truth, okay. They say, all right, they'd be nervous, you know, but okay, I'll do it. And so then they would have their debate, and he would always win the debate, and then they'd say, okay, and then they'd have to surrender, and they'd get on the bus. And many of the Prabhupada disciples you meet in America, many influential, they became devotees like this. So it happened with this man like that. And he said, okay, you come, and you live with us for 1 month, something like this, one month, something. And he said, after 1 month of practice, waking up with the devotees, chanting 60 rounds, and doing the practice that we do, and then you can go off and you can do your work and come back in the evening for the program. After 1 month, if you're not feeling closer to God, then fine. I don't know if he said exactly.
I will withdraw. You can withdraw. I am giving you in writing that the case which is filed by you win the matter and I lose the matter.
So then you win the case without even having to take it to court. But if you come here and you're feeling the benefit and you're feeling close to God, then you withdraw the case. That's what it was?
And then he became the disciple.
So then he not only withdrew the case, he became his disciple. So many stories are there like that. So many wonderful stories. Thank you very much for reminding me about that. I've gone over time. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, Prabhu, for your wonderful talk. Hare Krishna.